Greater labor efficiency has come about because of economics of scale, and the consequences include reduction of acres kept open for agriculture, a 90% loss of farms, abandonment of crop rotations, greater destruction of soils, increased pollution and water waste, greater pollution of air, greater use and waste of energy, destruction of wildlife, including bees, deterioration of food quality, and poorer health of the citizens from inadequate food supplies and nutrition containing harmful substances and less physical exercise. All may have an effect on health, mind, and intellect. That's the result of Extension's work in making farmers fewer, better, and more efficient. Bigness is better, modern beats older, education tops ignorance. They've all been incorporated into Extension's programs of work over these 100 years by a super dedicated group of teachers and clientele, each confident that their daily work and overwork could make a better life for their clientele. Extension used to be a social thing like the Grange. It was a great deal for 20 farmers to go out after milking at night and have a smoke together and talk about milk production. I told you about R.C. McWilliams over here in St. Albans. He was the old-time county agent. He always had some cigars in his pocket. He says, here we are. He says, the farmer's been cutting green chop out of this here. He says, you all cut green chop. He says, you ought to be pretty good at guessing the tonnages per acre. He says, how many tons per acre green weight do you think there is here? And those 20 guys just start guessing. He says, I got three cigars here for the three of you that can guess the best. And you get all kinds of guesses. They had no concept, really, of things, because that's the one thing that we always lacked on a farm was a pair of scales. We would blithely tell farmers 20 tons of manure per acre. How in the hell does he know? So I kind of looked into that a little bit. The size of a manure spreader is not just the size of the box, but it includes a kind of a rounded up pile over the top. It's actually a trapezoidal pile, if you look at the design of it. Farmers had no concept of how much manure they were spreading. And I wrote a thing about that for agents. I tried to write things like that. They were different for the agents to think about in the books that I had. And I had agro briefs and agro aids, both educational pieces for them to do. There's one of my pets on the fence out there running with a black walnut. But anyway, R.C. McWilliams, and I says, how are we going to know how much there is to do? And they said, how are we going to weigh it? Well, he said, I'll tell you how. He said, you measure in here a certain distance in and a certain distance there. And he had a wooden piece of wood, and he slid the wood in. He said, we'll cut the forage between here and here, and we'll weigh it and see how much it weighs, and we know what fraction of an acre that is. So I designed a stick based upon what he said. It had two pieces of dowel with points on it, cut to the right size. And I had Ken Varney, who's good at mathematics, figure out the exact area that we needed. So the three of these stuck in on the edge of hay as you're cutting it, just slide it in, and then go cut the area within that square. And the weight of these three, when measured on a scale, would be exactly the tons per acre. Pounds equal tons. That was a neat thing to have. I made one for every agent in Vermont and sent it to them. The dowel stuck into a piece of 1x2 at the header. I suppose they still have them. I have one someplace. I don't know where I put it. But I would have saved it for sure. That was a clever little thing to convince farmers what it was. Another time he had people, they had a 4-H club agent, and he had a half acre of snap beans as a 4-H project. He had farmers guessing at that. He got all the way from half an acre to two acres in that plot. It was exactly 1 acre. The farmers couldn't even guess the size of an acre, and yet they deal with that all the time. But it's surprisingly how far some of them could be. Those are simple little extension things that McWilliam used to talk about in the early days, but they'd make farmers think about things like that. He was a guy that I could learn a lot from. And Elmer Town, the Commissioner of Agriculture, he says, the size of a farm will ultimately be determined to how far you can afford to haul the manure. There's a great deal of wisdom in that statement. It's even that way today. I went to Derby, where the farmer up there, he's a college graduate. He'd been in our department taking courses. But he had 3,500 cows or something. He put so much manure on his fields that he polluted the town water supply, and they called me in, didn't want to know what to do. He was still using fertilizer. I said, first thing you do, I says, stop buying fertilizer. And then you got to do something with the manure. Well, he says, I can't put it back. I said, why don't you put it back where it came from? He says, I can't. He says, I'm cutting corn all the way down. He named the town. It was 30 miles away. He's hauling his corn 30 miles to that farm in some cases. He said, I can't afford to haul manure back there. And I thought of Elmer Town's statement, how wise it was. I think there's some catastrophe could come to the United States where we would shift back to a sustainable type of economy. My own daughter says, and I kind of kid with her and say, well, I'm going to keep these 74 acres. You may all want to come back here so you don't starve to death someday. I said, we got some wood to cut. You can grow almost anything here. We've got a reasonably moderate climate. You may not have a big job or something, but you could find a survival on this 74 acres. And she kind of starting to think that way herself in some ways. I think that it's foolish for us to think that we're going to return to normal, because normal is not going to be normal anymore with the energy supply in the world the way it is. I heard the other day by 20 or before, the price of oil will be consistently $100 a barrel. And by the year 50, it'll be $195 a barrel. At that point, we'll no longer be able to burn it to heat houses and keep them warm. How in the hell are people in Vermont going to keep warm? It's got to be solar, got to be wind, and that's going to be hard to do. I look at those new houses they build out on Spear Street in Burlington, great big monstrosities, bigger than mine by double. And I think this house is too big, and I feel ashamed almost to have it. And that's why we divide it off. Now, I heat that big room up for you today, but that's going to be 45 degrees as low as I can turn the thermostat. And I've been wondering about maybe just turning the heat off completely in that whole end of the house. And somebody comes to stay all night, I'll send them some other place to sleep because we just got one sleeping room there. But I'm also putting gas in that cottage, and that cottage can have a gas heater. It's fully insulated, has electric heat now, but it could have propane heat, and I could heat it up. My kids could come and live there for a week or two. If Jane and I got sick and they have to be here, where are they going to stay for the woman taking care of us is living in that room? But sustainable is not going to be sustainable according to the lifestyle that we have now. We're going to have to make a lot of concessions. State of Vermont, another squirrel. State of Vermont, $200 million in debt this coming year. They've got to find it someplace by taking away goods and services, they think. That's going to be a big problem that's going to strike home, and there are going to be a lot of people that are disappointed. They're expecting to get state handouts, which they won't be able to do. I think a lot about these things, but you don't hear it discussed very much because everybody's saying, well, we get the jobs back. And I wrote a whole dissertation on jobs. Jobs doing what? Unless the job makes something that you can sell to some foreign place other than Vermont or other than the United States so we can pay off our debts. The job is not to provide something for the laborer. The job is to provide something that the nation can sell. And you can't think of anything that we can produce cheaper than they can produce it in China and Far Eastern countries. And we used to have the technical advantage, and we don't have the technical advantage anymore. So you're going to have a job doing what? You're not going to get your old job back. These companies have learned to run on a shoestring now. Most every big company, Ford and all these other companies, they've laid off thousands of workers, and still they're able to produce automobiles because they've learned to put a mechanical thing in place of a man or a woman. They don't need all those people anymore. Never will. So what kind of a job are you going to give that guy if he can't make something that the country can sell? And if he's just going to make something, make shoes and sell them to somebody, and somebody else is going to make his coats, and somebody's going to wash his laundry, and he's going to wash theirs, that's not helping anybody. We're just shifting the money around the same group of people. We got to have something to pay off our debt. And if you can't make anything to sell, the next best thing is stop using oil. I've got five friends. Well, George McCollum, the entomologist, he doesn't believe in earthworming. There's a guy who's an engineer from Canada, Canadian Navy and all that, smart, got lots of money. He doesn't believe the earth's getting warmer. His wife doesn't believe the polar bears got a problem. They've been to see the polar bears. They saw lots of polar bears. I mean, how can they be so ignorant just to think that the earth is not changing and that we've got something to do with it? I just can't believe it, that they can be that blasé about something so important. When I was a kid, it covers my life till going in the Army. I've got the 500-page book when I was in the Army. I was going to do extension someday, and I've written bits and pieces of it. I don't have it here with me now, but I started doing the thing about that. I just don't work fast enough to do all the things that I need to do. I don't see it as promise. I see it as a possibility and an alternative, but I've got very, very negative opinions about whether we will ever accomplish anything like that. We won't do it until driven to do it and starved to do it. We don't have the brains to do that anymore. we, our whole people, and me included, are so used to the luxuries that we live in that I can't believe that we will go back to something by choice. We will only do it if it becomes economically or starvation or something like that driven. Charmed, but charming. I've led a charmed life, and I've led a charming life. There's a difference between those two words. I've been trying to define that and wrote down some synonyms because my wife says, well, that's the same word. Charmed and charming are two different words. When I say that I've had a charmed life, and you see how kind of I was brought up here, and I've written about it some there, I was either lucky, favored, destined, well-planned, trouble-free, predetermined, divine, or chosen. I don't know if somebody did it or whether it happened. But I led a very, very unspoiled life. And charmed is what I mean by that. I've been nearly killed several times, like running across sandbar with ice off a truck and came through my windshield. It drew blood and stuff and knocked me out. And I drove to chimney corners before I got out of the car. I was supposed to have two women for cider. I was driving to go get two women to Burlington. They'd have been killed. And charming life means that I've had a beautiful, easy, luxurious, pleasant life. But there's some destiny that I didn't get killed in the things that I came close to being killed for. That's what I meant by charmed. I don't think that people are drawn to things. I used to say that you fall into them. By the time you get through college, there's going to be something very definite. I said, prepare yourself for many things, for many alternatives. And I said, for all means, don't come here and say that you want to do this. I said, there's so many doors here at the university. I said, come and open one, which is true. The average student coming in as a freshman has no concept of the names that you can find in agriculture, like epidemiology and, you know, the genetic terms and geneticists. And nobody knew what an agronomist was. Kay Webb, when I went to work, I wrote my first publication. I used the word agronomy. She said, you can't say that word. I said, what do you mean you can't say it? I said, that's what I am. Oh, yes, but she says you can't say it because nobody knows what it is. I said, Kay, I'm here to make them understand what it is. And if I'm going to spend the rest of my life here, I'm going to use that word as many times as I can to teach as many people as I can what an agronomist is. And I think that I have popularized the word agronomist in Vermont more than any other single person that lives. I tell people an agronomist is a person that works with fields. It comes from the Greek word agros, meaning field. And I study everything in the field, in it and out of it and about it, as opposed to horticulture, which comes from the Latin mean hortus. And there you work with small size scale. And if you want to do big, big size scale, then it's forestry, and I'm that too. And I don't think that even my own administrators valued my services as much as they should have been valued. I think to ask him about Winway, oh yeah, he's a troublemaker. When Jerry McIntosh came, Jerry McIntosh told me that Wiggins and Callahan and maybe somebody else met him at the airport. And he says they hadn't said three sentences. He said, watch out for that Winway, he's dangerous. I think that I did a good job for Extension. I was egotistical enough to think that I did a good job, that I did more work than the average person in Extension, and that the quality of my work couldn't be questioned. I think I had a broader knowledge in a field of my work because of my past forestry experience and the fact that I did all these other jobs at the same time. I was a specialist in generalization, and because of that, I never feared an administrator that they could hurt me. I wouldn't care if they fired me. I was independent. I could always come back here. If Davidson fired me, it wouldn't matter a whit to me. I'd go get another job and could have easily some other place. I had people looking for me. The year I started work for Extension, I could have gone for the National Plant Food Institute, been located anywhere in New England, double the salary and a free automobile. And I turned it down. I could have gone to Washington, D.C. and worked for one of the parts of USDA that does with statistics and so on and agricultural stuff, particularly in fertilizers and lime. Double my salary. But I'd had to go to Washington. Turned it down. And the other one was the National Limestone Institute. Could have worked for them. I turned it down. I went over and asked Paul Miller, you know, what's it going to be like 5 years from now? Am I going to be able to get ahead? Oh, yeah, he says you'll get advances every year and so on. I never advanced one iota. I had cost of living increases from the time I started work until the time I retired. And I started at $5,000 and finished at $37,500 with a master's degree and 31 years for Extension. And I never knew what anybody else's salary was of the work that I do, and I don't know that you do today, but Davison kept them top secret. No agent ever knew what any other agent made. And every time they got their annual salary increase, they would all put down on a slip of paper what their increase was. They'd all drop them in a hat as to how much their salary went up, I guess it was. They always put them in the hat, and then they took the average out, and they told you the high and the low and the average. They did amongst themselves, but otherwise, I never knew. I never knew what another specialist made. It was top secret. And when I retired, I asked Vern, I said, I suppose I've killed myself a dozen times with administrators, and it probably hurt my salary quite a bit. He says, well, I can't tell you what others make. Vern's a great guy. I said, I know you can't. I said, I'd like to think that I made somewhere around what Dwight Eddy makes, because we did the same kind of work and got along good together. Well, he says, I can tell you you're about the same. That's all I ever knew about my salary. He actually came to work after I did, but Dwight was good. I came to the university. I finished my forestry school. I had enough time to go back and get a master's degree. I wanted to use up my GI time. I was married and had a wife and three kids, I guess, at the time. And I wanted to get home to Vermont. A couple of things I'd written, I wrote one for a fictitious job offer having to do, which would be called only an extension advisor, natural history advisor or something for the state. And I'd go around and lecture to people about things I was learning in school. It pretty much approximated what extension agronomy came out to be. But when I came here to get my advanced degree, I came here to get a degree for that so I could teach conservation. And they told me there's no such thing. You've got to be either forestry, you've got to be agronomy, or you've got to be botany or something or other. And I said, well, I'll get another degree in something. So I came here because I had worked the summer for Soil Conservation Service, and they would have hired me as a farm planner on the result of my work. I had a 5-point disadvantage there because the vets in New York got a 5-point advantage in the examination over me. But I beat them out anyway. I came to agronomy and told Dr. Midgley I'd like to get a degree in agronomy because I'm going to be a farm planner. And if I'm going to be a farm planner and I only know forestry, even though I was brought up on this farm here, I need to know something about agriculture. He says, don't do that. He says, you're a damn fool to do that. He says, you got a bachelor's degree, don't go get another one. He says, get a master's degree. I went to forestry department and asked them if I could get a degree. They would lead me toward extension conservationist thing. He said, you'd have to go back to school another 4 years and take a fifth year besides if you wanted to do that. And afterwards, all the rest of the time that he lived there, he said, I wished we'd taken you into forestry because I worked a lot with foresters. But I stuck with agronomy and I thought it was a small department and I'd get a lot of attention. Didn't turn out that way. It was a five-member department and Bill Kelly, and he started teaching me a lot of things and I had to teach one of his soils labs, which is before then. I couldn't give a talk to anybody without being scared shitless. And I got up in front of his lab and I saw 30 kids out there. I know more about what I'm talking about than they do. I don't know why I'm so scared about it. And I had to speak. I started teaching and I rapidly picked it up and I thought I think you'd call me a natural born teacher. I did it easily then. I never was scared to speak in front of anybody. And before the year was out, I had to go to Ontario and speak to 1,000 people at the Ontario Crop Improvement Association the year I started extension, not the year I started teaching. And then I went back because the Ontario fertilizer dealers want me to come back and speak to them. And I chose the title, Sell Yourself First. I said, you ought to know more about your product than anybody. When a farmer asks you about it, you should be able to tell them everything about it. And if you can't sell yourself on your own product that is good, then don't be trying to sell it to some farmer. And then I was invited back a second time to speak out there. I was, I guess you'd say, fairly popular as a speaker. I gave my manure talk over 100 times for Harvest Store, from here to South Dakota. Not everybody is an entertainer like that, because I tried to do some entertaining as I did it, because if you don't entertain, then you can't do a popular audience very well. So I had Vermont stories to tell them, and anecdotes that occurred in Vermont. They liked that wherever I went. Maud and Henry had been married for almost 60 years, and one cold morning they got up, Maud says, it's a bit chilly around here, I'm going to start a fire in that wood stove, and she said, and I'm going to use a little kerosene too. You tell me not to use kerosene, but she said it starts a fire pretty good. So she started the fire, and then she put on the kerosene. There's a hell of an explosion. Blew both of them right out in the dooryard. And when they picked themselves up, Maud says to Henry, you know, Henry, it's the first time in 65 years you and I have been away from home.
Speaking in front of a crowd and teaching.
Yes, I did. I did. And you're not talking, you're not knowing individuals that you speak to. You see them as a group, sort of, and you're not scared to look at them anymore, and you don't cry to your seat and sit down like I used to do. And when I tell people that, they don't believe it. And when I tell them I was the most bashful in high school, Burlington High School, it's in the yearbook, They don't believe that because they think now that I just run off at the mouth too much. And probably I do. But when people hire a speaker, they expect to get a speaker. I was asked by 4-H in Vermont to speak at the annual the Junior Leaders Conference or word like that. And they asked the speech department for a speaker to teach for two hours, two consecutive afternoons on a weekend with all this group of students coming here. And they declined. They asked Jack Spavin in our publications office, because that was kind of his feature, to teach extension methods. And he wouldn't do it either, but he said, I'll loan you some of the visuals that I've used. He says, I think you could do the job. And I said, well, I don't know about that. I said, I'll do it. And I went in before those students. I don't know how many there were, 65 or something in the room. And I told them about my crying and sitting down when I was a kid. I said, how many of you seen me on TV? Most of them put up their hands or heard me on radio. So they thought that I was something of a speaker. I said, whatever you think, I said, I was not always that way. I was bashful, even through high school. And even after I'd been 3 years in the Army and came back and took a course in public speaking, I was really, really in bad shape the day I had to give a talk to my speech class. But when I stood up in front of that other audience, I just made up my mind. I'm going to say in my own mind that I know more about what I'm going to talk about than they do, and I ought not to be afraid to tell them about it. And I think I've got something that they would benefit from if I say it. I say, if you have that attitude, it's like, yes, I can, then you can do it. And if I can do it, you can do it too, because I came from a small town. That's probably smaller than yours, 600 people. I had them raise their hands as to how many were small town people. So that was the title that I chose today, to tell them, learning to speak with confidence. And all you need is the confidence in yourself that you can do it. It applied to television. Yep, my television is all ad-libbed. You can't memorize it and you can't read notes. Now, I did have notes, but I was ashamed of myself sometimes that I had to follow my notes so closely. But the reason you have to do it with television is that the director's in a room where you can't see him and he can see you over a second camera. And when you want something, you have to verbally say, I would like to show you a picture of. But then once I had that other camera going, now I can tell him, do another. Finger signals, I can do another, because what's in that camera is only going to the director. He's using it for his eyepiece. It's not going out over the crowd. But to get going the first time, because he has the other camera on you that the crowd is showing, you have to tell him, now I would like to show you. Stuart Hall, and he said he had extension time and would extension like part of it. It would come around dinner time. And Davison was there, and he agreed, and everybody agreed that probably that's the coming thing, and we probably all should partake of it. And I jumped at it. I had learned a lot with visual aids, giving talks before TV, and I knew that I could do that. Plus, I had countless colored slides. Could you use colored slides? Yes, they can. But they won't be in color. They'll be in black and white. Because the early TV that we did was black and white, and you had to wear a blue shirt to make it appear like a white shirt on TV. You had to choose your color designs. I went down, and the first thing they said is, now you have to have a rehearsal. Because I volunteered to do one of the first programs. Director Davison may have said something on one program, but I think I did the first program. And it was on April 5th, 1955. I still have the instructions that I took down for the cameraman and for the person who was interrogating me, who was not Tony Adams, because we had several before him. Karen Christensen, for one. And then we had one from New York State. I told you his name the other day and can't think of it today. And then we had Fred Ashcraft, who was the very first one. And he was a flyer of small airplanes by radio. So the first one was Fred Ashcraft. I just sort of took to it like a duck to water, except that they said, now you have to rehearse it. So I did the rehearsal like it was a program. Now they said, we want you to do the program. Well, I got all mixed up over whether I had said it or I hadn't said it. I was not good at remembering what I had to say because it was a disaster. Well, the program wasn't, but it was a disaster for me that I couldn't do better. I did just two like that. And I said, now look, I enjoyed doing the program. I think I've done better on my practice one than I did on the real one. I said, why don't you just use my practice one and let me go? And they recognized that. And they let me run, and especially Karen Christensen. And I even got so I wouldn't ask questions of poor Tony. If I asked Tony questions, but he take him so long to get around to that, I said, I can say a lot more if I don't have to have Tony ask me the question. And so sometimes I just skip the questions, and he'd start me running, and I'd just keep going. Now, I tried to let him have two or three, because that was part of the program. But most of the time, the ones I liked are where they just turned me loose, and I did my own thing for 17 minutes or whatever it was. Those were the best ones I did. And all ad lib, except that I had to have directions for when I wanted a visual aid. And so the director had to know about the sequence of things. And if so, I had given him a sequence, then I had to kind of follow that sequence. So sometimes I had that, what I'd given him down to make sure I was going to not get him screwed up with what I wanted to see. The main thing about TV, though, and I mentioned this to you before, that when TV came in, public meetings took one heck of a whack. Because we used to have meetings all the time with farmers. Farmers, like women going to a social or going to a knitting roundup to make Christmas things. A part of it gets to be a social thing rather than just a knitting thing. And the same with farmers. They like to see each other and they like to compare notes and how their cows were doing and how far along they were in hay and stuff like that. And it gives them a chance to talk to each other when they went to a meeting. And they learned probably as much from talking with each other as they did from listening to me or to whoever was doing the meeting. And when television came along, that eliminated that feature. We used to have good attendances, 20 or 30 people out after milking for an evening meeting in the summertime. And we'd go to some farm, we'd look at somebody's farm fields. Sometimes he'd put us on the wagon. I remember a name, Gray, over in St. Johnsbury with a big John Deere, and he took 35 farmers on the wagon, which was too many. Man, you should see his front wheels rear up on that big green tractor he had. I thought he was going to come right over backwards, but he laughed. He knew just about how far he could go, not get into big trouble. Ed Gray, I think his name was. And we at that time also had Green Pastures Program, which was the first program that I came into at school. You know, you could talk about 14 hours about the Green Pastures Program. And of course, people have heard it so much. The Green Pastures Program, briefly, was where the governor of New Hampshire bet the governors of other states that they couldn't produce pastures as green as he could in New Hampshire. It took him 13 years to prove his point because everybody else won before he did. But it was a great program for farmers. And the biggest thing was that in order to be a farmer and enter the program, you had to have judges to judge them. Well, we couldn't hire that many judges or find them an extension, so we had to use farmers themselves for judges. And if you're going to have judges, you have to have a judging school. Now, there's a chance for education, to educate the judges. And once you get the judges educated, they had to go around and educate themselves by visiting all these farms to see which one they thought was nearest to being the winner. So there was another learning experience that they had by seeing three or four or five other farms before they made up their mind. And when that was finished on a county basis, then it came on a state basis. And you had people who were trained to be state judges. And you trained to be New England judges. And you got a trip to Eastern States Farmers Exchange to be recognized. Eastern States, not Farmers Exchange. We had Eastern States Farmers Exchange then, by the way, before there was any Agway. And their headquarters are Springfield, Massachusetts. They were very public-spirited, and they ran a lot of free events and brought farmers to them and helped out with the financial part. And the other agency that helped the Green Pastures Program was the Federal Reserve Bank. A man named Lou Zehner was in charge of their agricultural programs. And he took a very active part in supporting the Green Pastures Program. And every year we had a meeting at the Federal Reserve Bank, sometimes two or three, where extension agronomists from the all states would get together and also the officials from the state who were interested in each state contest. And it was a whole educational thing to go to the Federal Reserve Bank and spend a whole day listening to speakers and talking about agriculture and seeing what others were doing, and you do kind of the same thing. And sometimes we'd take our winners down. Or we had some Mendoza, and he was from Stowell, Morrisville, on the road going south out of Morrisville. And he was a great, jolly guy. He told the people in the Federal Reserve Bank down there, and he brought down the house. And people say, well, what do you need to get a lot of money out of dairying, and how do you want it to progress and so on? And he was a cowman. He says, what you need, he says, is a lot of cows that are built like the young schoolteacher. And he brought the house down when he said that. And when he took the New England judges around, we stopped at his house, and he had plenty of hard cider and good time. Mendoza was a great guy. I took him on a bus tour. One of the first things I did when I started Extension, it had all been arranged by Lester Smith, my predecessor. And we got on a Vermont Transit bus and headed out through western New York. And we went through the fertilizer plants. We went through the seed distribution facilities of different companies, as well as Eastern States Farmers Exchange and Greens League Federation of New York, which was what they joined to become Agway. And we took them through an automobile stamping plant where they stamped out the bodies and assembled automobiles. We took them to the experiment station in Ottawa. It was a grand trip that we had. It lasted, I don't know, 10 days, I guess. And we had trouble with the Vermont Transit buses. They wouldn't go up the roads out on Route 20 in New York State, and we finally had to switch back and go to old Route 5 that followed the river out. Had to get out and push the bus sometimes. And we also entertained a lot of bus tours from other states that came here under the auspices of the Green Pastures Program. And I remember going to Montreal a couple of times with Director Davison to talk about our Green Pastures Program. They never would let us accept anything from industry, but when we came home from there, each of us had a fat ham to bring home. They just insisted that we take it, and we told them we aren't supposed to take gifts. Well, since they were not our own audience in Vermont, why, Davison finally condescended and said, well, we'll take it home under that condition that it was given to us by members from a foreign country. Well, I used to have a lot of people come to my office, particularly in the later years and during the 60s and 70s and 80s. And the most common question was, I bought a new house in Vermont. They'd name East Overshoe, Randolph, Morrisville, wherever it was. And they'd say, I need some advice. He said, I got 10 acres and I don't know what to do with it. I thought a lot about that. And I thought, well, I've got the same problem up in North Euro, only I've got 64 acres and I don't know what to do with them either. Because this was a difficult question. And when you stop and think that whatever you do, there's probably somebody that can do it bigger, better, and faster, and cheaper than you can. So economically, you're not going to amount to very much unless you can find some little niche and do something special that nobody's out doing it anyway. And you might then have a chance to do it. But the first question I asked them was, are you doing this because you want to have fun with it? Are you doing this because you need some more money to live? And if you need more money to live, you probably ought to be thinking of some alternatives. Maybe not even farming. But if you want to have some fun, and maybe make some little money, but fun being the priority, then a little farming project is good. Dwight Eddy and I also worked this out one time with what to do with 10 acres. And I figured that if you started to grow your own food and could grow small animals, chickens and pork and beef and whatever, on 10 acres now, you've got grassland, you can graze, you can have grazing animals, you can grow corn, you can cut corn, you can pick corn, you can get corn grain, you can grow any kind of vegetable you want, any kind of fruit you want. And if you figured out what it costs to feed you, your wife, and two kids for a year, and I don't have those numbers now, but I figured out what it would be, I figured that probably the most lucrative thing you could do with it, instead of a job, is to grow as much of your own food as you possibly could grow. And you could grow everything that you need to eat with some things like tropical fruits and citrus and so on. And you would probably have enough little surpluses of some things to sell that would offset those. And that therefore you might make just as much producing your own food as a self-sufficiency type thing than you would trying to produce something to make money. But if you got into raspberries or something very specialized, well, maybe you could do okay. At least you could supplement your income, but you wouldn't be able to live on it completely. That was kind of the answer that I gave. I produced a lot of my own food over time. I used to have an acre of garden every year. One year I produced 30 bushels of potatoes, and we invited all of our friends from Burlington to come down and have a cookout with us, and everybody dug a bushel of potatoes and took them home. People say, do you sell your produce? No, I never sold any produce in my life, but I always had a garden sometimes 10 times bigger of things than I needed, and still find it that way when just Jane and I are here, and we're embarrassed that our freezers are overflowing, and the only trouble is my wife doesn't like frozen food very well. It's something that I accept. Swiss chard, to me, frozen, is no different than Swiss chard fresh out of the garden. You're going to cook it and wilt it anyway. And I don't see where it tastes one iota difference frozen than it did when it was fresh. So I got a bootle of that in the freezer, but my wife kind of spurns it. I eat it for breakfast sometimes. A little vinegar, salt, pepper, and butter on it. Up until last year, and we've been married for 62 years, we had never bought potatoes. There was a reason, I forget what it was last, '09, but '08. In '08, I didn't plant potatoes, and we have other responsibilities with the cabins, and something was going on at the potato planting time, and we said, just forget it this year. But you know, one good thing happened. This year, I never had any potato bugs and grew a whole crop of beautiful potatoes, and not a bug and not a spray. For the whole year. Now, when you rotate potatoes, you not only have to rotate the land that the potatoes grow on, but you don't want any potatoes in your garden. They also like eggplant and they like tomatoes. to some degree. If you don't have any of those around for 1 year and forget everything completely, it'll make a big difference in the population because the insects will have nothing to eat that odd year. And they're going to starve to death, and you won't have many the year following. There's a natural means of control, but it's a rotation longer than just an alternating one-year thing in one place. Or if you've got 64 acres like I do, you probably should grow potatoes on the back 40 and not up front. But even then, you'd be surprised. Potato bugs will travel the longest distance to get from one place to another. If you've got them anywhere in your place or your neighbors are there, and you grow potatoes, they'll find them. But there's nobody growing potatoes around here. I don't know of anybody that grew any potatoes within a mile of me. It's the first year I've ever had potatoes that I didn't have to spray for potato bugs. When NOFA started, they wanted people that were sympathetic to non-conventional things. And many of our people, I'll say most of the people, kind of scoffed and made fun of people with an organic philosophy. But I was fairly broad-minded. And I won't say that I was a sympathizer necessarily, although maybe sympathizer is what I was. But I've never joined NOFA, and I don't want to be termed an organic farmer. But I'm kind of in the middle someplace. I chided them about some of the things that I believed they were doing that didn't matter a whit, and I chided regular farmers for not doing some of the things that they were doing, like practicing better rotations, for example, or like composting. And I made fun of them for composting. By saying, what do you want to compost things for? Because it's never done in nature. What's so natural about it? You're taking the organic matter from the waste materials from whatever you grow in your garden or on your farm and putting them in a pile and heating them up and feeding them to a bunch of strangers, strange bacteria. And you might better put all of those organics into the ground so that your garden would benefit from the heat that's produced and your garden would benefit from the amount of nutrients that are liberated from the process. In the cold Vermont soils, some extra heat could do your crops a lot of good because all the things that we grow need more heat than we usually can provide. So I chided both sides, and I won't say I played both sides, but I think I was understanding enough to both sides so that they both trusted me very well. The conventional agriculturalists, conventional farmers, I believe trusted me and didn't say, well, he's not an organic guy. And the organic people trusted me as one of the few people who would go to their meetings and show some sympathy for what they were trying to do, because I could see a lot of advantages in some of the things they did, if for no other reason than it did them a lot of good to do what they're doing for themselves. So the first year they had these meetings, we went at a camp, like a Kiwanian camp, down in New Hampshire, a very primitive summer camp for kids. We had co-ed bathrooms even, co-ed everything. We took a wheat grower with us from down in Bridport to talk about wheat. Temperatures reached 100 degrees, and we had these small classes scattered around under the trees and around the buildings and whatnot, doing our lecturing outdoors because it was cooler than inside. And I remember this particular farmer now, he was rather surprised because, well, I was kind of overdressed because I had a pair of shorts and a tank top on. And that's what most people did, but the guys took their tank tops off right in his class. Several of the women took their tops off, too, because they didn't want to be outdone by the men. And he'll never forget that. And we learned a lot, and speakers like me would go there, but there weren't many extension people that wanted to. So I gave them lectures on growing dry beans, which was a kind of an odd thing. I gave them advice about nutrient deficiencies in plants. I mean, nobody can argue with that type of things on how plants grow, how nitrogen behaves, how nitrogen gets lost, how phosphorus pollutes. You know, I taught them all of the standard role of stuff in agronomy. I was their agronomy teacher. And I gave them over the years about 50 lectures over a period of 15 years. And those lectures then could have been used by regular farmers, but they never bothered to delve into the material to that degree. But these people were real students of what they were doing, and they wanted to know about these things. And so you might say that the NOFA audience was a much more sophisticated audience than the average farmer who thought about the big things and whether his tractor would run and whether he's going to make any money from the milk check that he got this week and so on. They had more time to think about the ethereal things as to whether this is going to affect their nutrition and what's it going to do for the environment and how it's going to affect each other. And they wanted to do a lot of the old-time things. One of them came and gave a lecture on switchel, which is the liquid that old farmers used to drink during haying, made out of vinegar and honey and a few other things that were added. As a matter of fact, we got so interested in that that we gave it to the American Society of Agronomy when the Northeast section met in Burlington, Vermont. And we had coolers of iced tea and other things for them. And we had one cooler with just switchel in it. And most of them had never heard of switchel before. But they all had a taste of it and thought it was pretty good. It would keep you from getting thirsty in the hayfield. So over the years, they developed a lot of trust in me, and I managed to speak as much as three times. And once I went across the border to Canada, they had concurrently an English-speaking conference and an English-speaking conference. And I only wished that I could speak French, but I couldn't. And two of the speakers didn't show up, and after I'd given my three talks, I had two more in the car, and I went out and got those out because there was no speaker to fill in, and they did that. That year, I gave five talks to them. I took a course in biological agriculture because somebody with money in Massachusetts, some trust, I think, paid for my way to go to Europe and study organic agriculture, which I did on a trip, took my wife with me at her expense, and came back again. The university didn't even want to give me the time to go. I took nothing from the university. I took my own vacation and this outside source of funds and came back having seen 17 different farms in four different countries with a lot of things to be learned that I had not learned or wouldn't learn here in the United States. And I put together a talk called Biological Agriculture in Europe. Extension Service never asked me to give that talk. Nobody in Extension or related activities. But I was asked to give that talk to NOFA. And I was asked to give it at the conference across the border north of Newport in Sherbrooke, Quebec, at Bishop College. And the two leaders of NOFA were there who had started it. Can't say the names just offhand. And one of them came up afterward and he said, "I want you to know," he says, "you made me cry." He said, "You brought tears to my eyes with your attitude about organic agriculture and what you saw. We've never seen that kind of a thing from those college people down there before." He said, "I couldn't believe it." But he said, "You made me cry." I took that as a big compliment. The spading fork was actually even more precious to me because it was the first time they had ever given an honorary award to somebody who had done the most to promote organic agriculture in New England. And instead of choosing one of their own, which they could have done because there were dozens of them, or someone from another college, they chose me, an outsider and a member of the college community, whom they looked upon kind of as the enemy. It was like the enemy. And I always said it was like Rabbi Wall getting an award from Bishop Joyce in Catholicism. Well, I graduated from forestry school in the winter of 1950 in January because I had 6 months credit in civil engineering from UVM prior to the war. And I'd been away for 3 years, and one in Western United States and 9 months in India, 9 months in Burma, 3 months in China, and traveled around the world and was back again. And then the 4 years at forestry school. And so when I came to UVM, it was in 1950 in the winter. And immediately I started my master's program, which took me less than 2 years. Not because I was smart, but that's about what a master's program takes. And maybe hastened a little bit by the fact that Joe Kelly left to go in the Korean War and left me dangling as a graduate student with no advisor. The others tried to make up for it, but it wasn't the same because he was my, not spiritual, but soil spiritual advisor. He was teaching me The Soul of Soil, which was a title of a textbook that one of our students wrote. Grace, and I can't say her last name now, which is an interesting book to read. I started teaching then in 1951, actually, and was told by the university after 4 years that I had to get out, that they had passed a rule in 1950 when I went there that I could only stay 4 years and then had to either get a doctorate degree or show the highest degree attainable in my profession or show advancement toward it. And since I didn't want to go away to graduate school with three kids and a wife in some foreign place like Minnesota or Michigan or Cornell or Purdue, I decided that I would just do something else. And they said, "Well, how would you like to be the extension agronomist? Because Lester Smith, whom you've been helping out lately, is leaving for good at Purdue. I just learned that." They said, "Would you like to take his position? It does not require the doctorate." I said, "I sure do." And I took it. And I moved from one door to the next door to it and stayed for 31 years. And I was glad that I did because being extension agronomist is a very favored position, I think. It's not a boring job where you go and do the same thing every day, like sitting at a computer or even teaching the same class where you teach it. Glenn Wood, I think, taught for 30 years, and he taught the same course year after year after year, and he either had it memorized or he had it all written down. And mine was never like that. Every time I gave a talk, I was almost starting from scratch, although I did some repetition. My greatest repetition was pollution is people. I gave that 250 times by actual count, with the same set of slides to little kids in first grade, to senior citizens at a night meeting, and preached it three times in lieu of a chairman of church and all places in between, Kiwanians and Rotarians and all the civic and social groups in the state and whole school assemblies. I never had such a talk that had such a wide range of things, because people are all polluters regardless of who you are. And I was trying to attempt to show them how to find out. But I had other talks like the whys and hows of liming, the whys and hows of fertilizing. I did one for roadside beauty one day. Somebody said, what are all these weeds growing by the roadside? Well, I said, they're beautiful flowers, they're not weeds. And I started from North Hero and took a collection down to the studio, did a studio program on that for TV, and then thought, well, I'm going to make a slide talk out of that. So I made a slide talk out of it with probably 140 slides and showed you all the things that you'd see as you could whiz by at 40 miles an hour and probably never noticed. But if you'd stop and look, there's a great beauty there by the roadside. And then the beekeepers of Vermont wanted me to do something for them. So I took a lot of those slides and others, because it dealt with flowers, and put them together and showed bee pasture. That's a strange term for most people, bee pasture. And bee pasture are those plants that are used by bees as a source of nectar, which is sugar, and pollen, which is protein, and propolis, which is the sticky stuff on the outside of buds and the springs that they use to glue their hive together and patch up repair work. And it's pretty interesting. I just started out in the spring with the first one I could find, like pussy willow, and I went right through the last thing in the fall, like maybe a wild aster, which would be one of the last in the fall, if not the last. I did all kinds of talks on subject matter like that. Some talks I gave once. Some I gave a lot of times. I gave several of them over 100 times. And the preservation of manure was one. But I put the word perishability. The perishability and the profitability of manure. And I gave that well over 140 times. And people thought, well, that's a funny thing, the perishability of manure. Does manure spoil? Yes, it does. And when I gave that talk, I tried to emphasize that it is a highly perishable product, and as soon as it's voided in the form of urine or feces by cows, the urea wants to change into ammonium carbonate, and the ammonia goes poof into the air, unless you can catch it or do something to keep it in place. And that led into the whole use of the use of superphosphate in Vermont as part of the agricultural conservation program, because you spread superphosphate in the gutter not only to preserve that nitrogen and change it to a form that would not volatilize or evaporate, but you also kept it away from the soil, and you also gave the farmer a means of preserving it to take to the field and use later on. And because it wasn't in the air, it made the barn smell better, and when they did the milking in the barn instead of in a parlor, then the milk tasted better. There were all sorts of economic advantages to the use of super manure. This is a real strange story to tell, too, because when agricultural conservation program started, and we recognized that phosphorus was one of the weak links in Vermont agriculture, because we had never used any, and many of our soils were notoriously low. Like even on my own farm, they were so low that when Weatherby got samples, he wondered, what's going on up in Grand Isle County? He said, I got a whole bunch of farms up there. I can't find any phosphorus in them. I said, well, it's this way, Bob. I said, we want to show our new soil tests and how good they are. So we told the ACP committeeman to send you some samples from their best field and from their poorest field. And those poorest fields would never have had any, and the best fields, of course, would. And I said, you're seeing their poorest fields. That's how low we were. On a scale of 100, they were down in ones and twos, which he could hardly read as a color comparison. And so that was kind of an interesting thing. But the gist of what I wanted to say here is that the farmers at first objected to any kind of government help. Vermont farmers are pretty independent people. You know, they'd starve before asking somebody to send over some food. And they would not use fertilizers donated by the government because they don't want to have to take government help. The situation was so bad they couldn't start the program in Vermont because farmers wouldn't participate. And they went to Professor Dyckhusen at the university, who was a teacher of ethics. And he actually wrote, and you can still find it in the files, a publication by the Vermont Extension Service by Professor Dyckhusen to convince farmers that it's okay to take government help if it's being done for a good cause that's going to help the general good for everybody. And phosphorus was one of those things. And as a result of his publication, he was able to convince Vermont farmers that getting superphosphate in the gutter at 2 pounds per day was such a common good for every farmer in Vermont, like putting iodine in your salt to prevent goiter, that we became the state with the highest participation in that phosphorus program of any state in the United States. I think we had like 90% participation. No other state could match us. And it was his publication, the turning point, to say, it's okay, guys, as long as you do some good with it. But don't accept government money for nothing. I sat down one day with my favorite pencil and a piece of yellow paper, and it says at the top, Kodachrome, the love of my life. Kodachrome, in the form of slides, and lately prints of all sizes made from slides, has enriched my life as much as any other factor I can think of. It has given me pleasure beyond measure. It has taught me creativity, travel adventure, and agronomic teaching, livelihood, a TV career, among the other attributes. And it now serves me as a historian, a collector of the past, the way our friends change, and memories of our children and grandchildren. And my love affair with it started about 1938 when Kodachrome originated and was developed by Kodak. I feel that way about Kodachrome. It's partly laziness on my part. When I went to the studio, is it easier to take all the flowers that grow between Arthur and Burlington, or is it easier to take a handful of slides and arrange them to do the same thing? And the advantage of the slide is that if I want to show you the nutrient deficiency on a plant with a leaf the size of your thumb, I can use my close-up lens on that thumb and I can blow it up 5 feet wide on a screen, well, 6 feet I carried on the screen to talk with farmers and homeowners. And I can, it's better than being there with you with a handheld microscope. And I could teach you things that you wouldn't even see by looking at them just normally. You can also arrange and rearrange easier than you can chuck around a bunch of potted plants or any kind of dead plants. And so laziness on my part was one thing, but the other thing was that during my career I gave something like 3,000 talks. That's one every third working day for 3 years. And if you have to make up a different talk for everybody, and in addition to about 800 television shows, and you're going to use some other pictures and books and stuff, you can have at your hand a collection of everything that grows in Vermont and everything that ails plants in Vermont, everything that eats plants in Vermont, and also show their beauty in a way with photography that you cannot do by any other way. And so photography, especially Kodachrome, has been an important part of my life. And as of this year, in 2009, the Kodachrome disappeared. And I've told you this before, but I also used it during my Army career because I was one of the only people in my outfit of 250 that had Kodachrome pictures to take, and I took about 500 or 600. They are so rare that the people who have been watching the XCBI Roundup, which is a government, which is an Army magazine from World War II, said they had never seen colored pictures from that part of the world before, except the ones I sent them. Now, I don't know what to do with those pictures, but what I have are exceedingly rare. And I figure that the pictures that I've taken for agriculture are also equally rare, for I could show you by means of, for example, the talk, Deficiency Symptoms in Plants. I can show you every deficiency that I have ever seen, deficient on every crop that I have ever seen in the state of Vermont, all in one talk, and project it on a screen, or put it on a, today you can put it on a disc, so you can see it on your TV or see it in any way and show it to thousands of people, because most people have never seen zinc deficiency on corn. And we never had at the university until the year, and I forget which one it was, that I was asked to go down by Bob Carlson, the county agent, because he said the farmers got magnesium deficiency and wants to know what to do about it down in Shelburne Farms. It's on the Webb Estate, actually. It's on the beef farm, which is one reason we were seeing it there. Well, he didn't know what it was, and the farmer didn't know what it was, so I went down and looked, and it just happened that I had read a picture book pamphlet from Brazil written the year before, and in it was a picture of zinc deficiency on corn. Two white stripes on either side of a midrib and dark green in between, and white on the outer edges of the leaves as well. So I have four white stripes. And I took with me a Dr. Rich Bartlett and another doctor from the university. And when I saw that, I said, that's not magnesium deficiency. I've never seen it before in my life. I said, but I think that looks like zinc. Oh, go on. Nobody ever saw zinc deficiency in Vermont or in New England, for that matter. It's never been studied, reported, or anything. I said, it looks like it. It's a very distinctive thing. Bet you money it isn't. We bet each other money, and I won the bets. Because my wife and I went off to Cornell for a week, and before we went, we bought six sprayers down at Old Strong Hardware in Burlington, put a different chemical in each one, sprayed the corn that was growing poorly, went off and came home 5 days later, went to see the manager at the Webb Farm. You see any change in what we did? Oh, yes, he said. I said, what was it? And I knew because I just looked at him. The one that has zinc. I said, what are you going to do about it? Do about it? Hell, I did that 2 days ago, he said. We sprayed it on with airplane. And it corrected the deficiency like you wouldn't believe. The corn got so that it was twice as big and all the leaves turned green. One of the more spectacular ones that you could possibly do, more spectacular than nitrogen. And later they found zinc deficiency on apples in Maine and accidentally discovered it because they were using a zinc fungicide. And the plants were growing better, and they always thought that there was the fungicide because it cured disease that made the apples grow better. And in fact, they were putting zinc on the plant and corrected the zinc deficiency. I came home, and I have Benson soils on my farm, the same as the soils at Shelburne. These are high lime soils. And lo and behold, I was growing dry beans at the time. And even though they were half grown, I got a response to my dry beans. I should have known this because out in Michigan, they use zinc all the time, and it's a well-known problem with beans. But we never heard it on any crop before in Vermont and did correct it. And subsequently, I influenced the Agway people so that they created a special corn starter in which they added zinc and boron and magnesium to the 10-20-10 that was a starter fertilizer, so it had high phosphorus. And they put it out in a purple, sexy bag so that farmers would want to buy that stuff. And I think that it helped lots of farmers get their corn off to a better start. Not every farmer would have had the zinc deficiency, but this beef farm, you see, he lost control of his manure because you can't capture beef manure and put it back on the land. He was growing corn continuously on the land, which caused this corn soil to erode. He lost organic matter on the erosion, and it was a rolling type of land. So you were losing the supply that was there that was washing away, or it didn't have it. And to correct this, he'd added phosphate, and you add phosphate, and it ties up zinc. So he had about five reasons why we'd have zinc deficiency on such a field. Well, that's a big deal to discover something new that nobody's known or seen before, or that you could have the influence of having a co-op help farmers by putting it in the fertilizer. I don't look like a farmer necessarily. People say I don't even look like a Vermonter, and many people have told me I don't talk like a Vermonter because I don't have the twang, and I think it's because I just didn't grow up on a farm, but here I have a piece of land. I actually was living, my living was in the inn in North Hero, which is the old Irving house, which is now the North Hero house. My grandfather built it in 1896, and my grandmother died when I was four, so my mother and father lived there before I was born, and she became the woman of the house. And so that was my home, and my grandfather lived there as a family. And in addition, we had a farm connected with it with 14 cows or 15 cows, four horses, chickens, and pigs. And there's a big barn by it. And the land where I am now supplied the feed for it because we corner on that land. And so, yes, I was brought up on a farm with the 15 cows. The cows had pasture. We grew crops like buckwheat. We grew crops like oats. The threshers came once a year and did the threshing. So we used our own grain, so to speak. And I'm proud to say that I've helped put up cocks of hay in the field that could be loaded on the farm wagon. We had horses, and we didn't get a tractor until 1936. And then when we acquired and moved the cows up to Sure Acres Farm, you had to go on a paved road, and you couldn't use lugs on a paved road, so we bought the first rubber-tired tractor in town. But I also was not a typical farmer because I was brought up in the North Hill House, which was an inn. And summer visitors came in the summertime, and they all talked New York and Pennsylvania and all different languages. So I was brought up with a hodgepodge of things and not stuck out on an isolated Vermont farm like some farm boys would have been. I never had a problem with money. They wanted frogs to go fishing. They wanted worms. The frogs could be picked off the pasture down in back of where I now live, penny apiece, and you could pick them up as though they were like pennies that were spilled on the ground, the little frogs at the right time. You could catch grasshoppers and crickets for them. And I could pick up earthworms every time it rained. So I always had these things on hand in a cool place so I could sell them. And at 9 years old, they couldn't find a fishing guide one day. So my father said, well, he knows where it is out on the reef. So take these two guys out fishing. I took them out. They caught the limit. They paid me the $10. I mean, that was big for a little kid at that time. We're talking about a time when the hired man was getting $1 a day, room and board. And I got $10 for taking two guys fishing and having fun with them at the same time. And they hired me for two more days, so there was $30 just like that. Plus, I charged them for the bait we used. So I was brought up under a very unusual circumstance. And being in the inn, because we had to take foreign people, we had the first flush toilets in town. We had the first central heat with a furnace in town. We had the first generator, 32-volt Delco generator for electric lights in town. We had the first of everything that was modern, so that makes me very untypical. I mean, some guys never got those in their lifetime. And then I did get the piece of land that we're on, which fortunately is high lime soils. It doesn't require lime. Shallow to bedrock, but still it's an interesting farm. We don't know how to use it at the present time, so maybe we need to be producing grapes like one of my son has the idea of, or maybe we need to produce some exotic crop on it. But for now, I can't do more than I am at the age that I am. And so it just sits there, and we give all the hay away to a man who's got some black Angus. We had one last year, and unfortunately, he passed away. And now we have another one who has a small herd, and he puts it up in big rolls and takes off. But for 25 years, we sold hay here. And from 1957 to 1965, we were the largest bean grower in the state of Vermont with about 20 acres, harvested 10,000 pounds, put them in 2-pound packages under the trade name Vermont Hero, and took them to every store that we could find in Vermont. And I did it as an experiment to see where do people eat beans, and tried to get the idea that beans are no longer for poor people. They're a gourmet item, and you get good prices for these beans. My good prices at that time were 25 cents a pound. A 2-pound package we sold to the grocer for 50 cents, and he sold it for 69 cents. And today, when I go look at a 2-pound package of beans, they're $3.85 for the 2-pound package. I should be in the bean business today. Those things help me be a better person, I think, for other people. Because if you have these crops, and I experimented a lot on my own farm, I could try things that I wouldn't ever dare tell a farmer to experiment with because it might be a financial disaster for him. I've had all different kinds of alfalfa varieties. One year I had 22 different kinds of tomatoes. I've grown the potato collection from the farm show, which was 22 different kinds of potatoes, and kept them all separate. Most of them weren't worth a damn, but they were funny to look at and interesting to be. And I've learned a lot by doing those things, and that's helped me in my extension work because I can speak with a great familiarity with seeding a crop, growing a crop, harvesting a crop, diseases and things on it. It really was part of my education, more important and better than I got in my master's degree at the university, which happened to be on the base exchange capacity of Vermont soils, which means their ability to hold nutrients. That's highly specific. Being associated with the farm, and all at the same time, I didn't mention, my father ran the local garage, and so I had a great familiarity with machinery and of all kinds, and the familiarity with the hotel and meeting other people. Carried two luggage, got 50 cents. It gave me an idea that I can look upon the agricultural world through a funnel. You look in the small end of a funnel, and there's a whole world out there that broadens and broadens and broadens as the funnel gets bigger. And if I had gone to graduate school to get a degree, I would have gone to Cornell or someplace, and they would have taught me to look in the big end of the funnel, and I'd look narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower down to a little thing like that. And what would I know? A person with a doctor's degree is less well able to do extension work than a person who has some broader education, which prompted Will Rogers to say one time, There's nothing so ignorant as an educated man once you get him off the subject he was educated in. And if you want to do extension work, you need to be educated in a broad variety of things because your audience has a broad variety of interests. And not every agronomist in the United States could stop on Church Street in North Hero, as I did one day, and a woman said, "Well, you're Win Wei, aren't you? I've watched you on TV. Say, do you have a good recipe for making dill pickles?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, I do. Do you have a pencil and paper?" And yes, she did. And I wrote her down the recipe for making dill pickles because it turns out I'd made 100 quarts of dill pickles every year for 10 years and put them in 2-quart jars and often took them to almost all the meetings where I spoke that had a dinner. Even though I was the speaker and didn't have to do it, I felt kind of guilty enjoying their good food without bringing my share for potluck stuff. I'd take 2 half-gallon jars of pickles with me. I did. It was the most enjoyable work you could find. You never do the same thing 2 days in a row. You never talk about the same subject. You always have a different audience. You have a different perspective on things. You never know what kind of a trouble is going to crop up, whether it's growing trefoil seed down the Champlain Valley, or whether they're having problems with potatoes up in the Northeast Kingdom, or whether they're growing alfalfa in Grand Isle County, which incidentally, we were the first county to grow alfalfa. In 1900, I think there were 38 acres of alfalfa in the state, and I bet you they were in Grand Isle County, because we had natural soil and never have to apply lime. All you had to do is spread seeds. And the same way trefoil grows through the Champlain Valley. And you can work your heart out trying to grow it in eastern Vermont and the rest of the state. It grows on roadside some, but you don't see it elsewhere. And one of the reasons is that it has a demand for sodium. And sodium soils exist in the Champlain Valley from the old Champlain Sea, where the salt water, brackish water ran in. And we still have a skeleton of sodium in Champlain Valley clays of 800 pounds of sodium per acre that no other part of the state can claim, except on roadsides where we use road salt. And there, trefoil grows to beat hell sometimes because it likes that sodium. They discovered that at Wisconsin and Cornell. Oh, I had strange requests like you just wouldn't believe. It's hard to think on the spur of the moment what strange request. I'll tell you one of the strangest ones that rather bothered me a little bit. Phil Grime called over from St. Johnsbury and says he's got a farmer with some problems over there. He says he wondered what kind of information I could give him. He says he's got a bunch of hogs over there that he raises, and they're not confined. They're out on pasture and stuff. And he says one of the things he's been feeding them, he says he buys the paunches of cattle from a slaughterhouse, and he's taken the haunches of cattle out and put it on his pasture out there. And the animals are eating everything, but not just paunches, but the animals. He says they're eating everything up. He says, but they leave the paunches. They don't seem to want to do those. And so what could he do with the paunches of 50 dairy cattle? Phil, I said, you got me. I said, I'll just tell you, I want to get rid of those things in the easiest possible way that I could think of. I said, it just amazes me to even think about it. That was a tough one, I thought. But I was pleased about the zinc one, which turned out to be right. I was also pleased to go to some of the forestry things. I helped some of the Christmas growers with the idea of how much nitrogen they should put on a tree because they want to make it greener in the year of harvest. The fact that potassium deficiency on sandy soils can exist even on trees that don't require a lot of fertility. And I learned this down in Saratoga when I went to forestry school. Even though they didn't teach much about fertilizers, they had examples of old, worn-out land that was sandy where farmers hadn't used fertilizer, and potassium leaches out. So when they planted evergreen trees, whatever the kind, pines, the trees wouldn't grow until they got to be about 13 years old. When they finally discovered the answer, they found that the sand was 13 feet deep, and down below that was a clay layer that trapped the potassium, because it has the ability to do that by ion exchange. And when the roots got down there, they would hit the potassium, and then they'd take off. And they dug soil pits 13 feet deep and had stepladders to get down in the soil pit to examine these soils. And anything they put on the top that had potassium, even the slash, and that slash means the leaves and the stems from the trees before, anything with potassium in it would make those plants come out of their potassium deficiency. So I used this to advantage in several places, but up in Wolcott, I discovered the other thing, that certain ions antagonize each other. There is a relationship between calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium. And there's also between the anions, the nitrates, sulfates, and chlorides, and phosphates, and so on. And these ions all have to count up. And if you take away one of the four ions and do something to disrupt potassium, then you're going to have magnesium deficiency on the tree. And one of these says that the tree is going to have yellow tips, and the other says that the tree is going to have dying older needles. And you can tell them apart visually as to which is which. But as soon as you try to correct the potassium deficiency, you'd better well add some magnesium, because you're going to tip the balance and throw it out of kilter. And we did that up in Wilka, and I created magnesium deficiency on the trees when I really only went there to correct the potassium deficiency, but I created another one by doing it. And so balanced fertility, when you hear that word, has to do with that. And I was very proud of discovering that. And in the nursery in Essex Junction, Bill Hall, the county forester, and others were having trouble growing red pine. The seedlings that they put in had a deep red wine color in the fall. And he wondered, what's wrong with these trees? So I said, they obviously didn't call it red pine because it's red, because red pines are supposed to be green. And so we put phosphorus on. And you should see the results that we got. The next spring, we had some blocks were all green. Some were still red if we hadn't treated them. A great thing to find out. I mean, foresters didn't know this because they knew very little about potassium and phosphorus fertilization at the time. And so I helped several of the Christmas tree growers by adding these materials. People still call me, and I have a letter right now sitting over there from the guy that used to work for Northern Farms Milk Cooperative, which I wrote a column for 25 years until they stopped publishing it. And this letter is asking me about this fellow's potatoes. He lives in California in the winter, and he lives in Vermont in the summer, and he tries to grow something in his own garden. And, of course, this year everybody had blight on their potatoes, like the old blight from Ireland. I didn't have that blight, by the way. Maybe because I didn't grow potatoes the year before and I didn't get the bugs. Maybe I didn't get the blight for the same reason. There was no source of infection to infect my potatoes this year. So I had a good crop of potatoes this year. But he's wondering, can he plant the potatoes in the same place the next year? My advice to him is no. Either skip potatoes or go to someplace quite far away. Now, I'm not saying there's going to be blight next year. You never know, but you're taking the chance if you go back to an infected area and do it again. You don't walk in and catch a cold after somebody's been there sneezing. I have other people ask questions. Especially friends. Gordon Smith lives in Grand Isle, and he's a Canadian, but he has a garden. He's always got questions about how much manure to add, when should he rototill, where should he plant his peas. A lot of people don't know that peas get root rot. When I took my master's exam, Dr. Midgley, my department head, was a very knowledgeable person, and he was my mentor, and I loved him. And I had several people came to give me an oral examination. Well, I had an economist that came, and he didn't know enough about ion exchange in Vermont soils to ask me a question pertaining to that. And so he said, now my aunt grows peas up in central Vermont in Plainfield, and she's got a problem with her peas this year. They're all turned yellow, and they didn't do well. Wonder if your research work on ion exchange would have anything to do with that and whether you could help her. Well, I was pretty green at that point, and I didn't have all the experiences that I've had since. And I was hammering around trying to figure an answer for him. And Dr. Midgley came to my rescue, and he says, well, perhaps Mr. Way does not yet know that if you plant peas in the same place for 2 or 3 years, that you gradually build up a population of the root rot organism, and you've got to stop growing peas in that place for 2 or 3 years if you want to have peas grow clean again. So he was able to help me out. But it was a simple thing, and it works a lot of times. Common sense is a lot of things, but more and more as we specialize and learn more about computers and electronics and so on, people lack the common sense to answer a lot of their own questions. I spoke 1 year to the northeastern section of the American Society of Chemistry, and they asked me if I would come and speak to them, because they wanted me to speak to the subject of why people should take chemistry in schools and why you should encourage your children to take a course in chemistry in high school, even if you're not going to become a chemist. And my answer was, yes, you do need to have that course. I said, I'm very proud of the fact that I've had both physics and chemistry I especially enjoyed, not because I was so good at it, but because it's so useful. I don't see how anybody in our modern world, whether they work with electronics or work with automobiles or work with food or whatever, can say that they're educated or can even exist and do well for themselves if they don't understand the chemistry of how bread is made with yeast, why the cake rises when you put baking soda, and why you put baking powder in your pancakes, because without the acids you don't make the bubbles and the bubbles don't make the thing rise and you don't have a texture. And I don't understand how they can be fertilizing their lawns and know what to put on if they don't understand how nitrogen works, the fact that it makes plants green, phosphorus makes roots, and potassium makes sugars, and how these three things can be put on at different amounts at different times, or maybe why you don't need them at all, or why you do. Without chemistry, I don't see how a person leads a modern life, because I can psych out a lot of problems sometimes just from simple things about chemistry that you know. If you know hot air rises and cold air sinks and so on, may help to prevent freezing your vegetables. Everything is interrelated, but people today are so deficient in the world around them because everything is artificial that we do, electronics and automobiles and typewriters. One of the things I did is I love to be creative. I love to think about things that other people haven't thought of, like finding the zinc deficiency. But I also love to work with the tools of agriculture. And these tools are some things that I had written down on a piece of paper and we're going to show you sometime. In fact, it's right under this, if I may pick it up. My work in agronomy required tools, not only a brain to think, but also a great deal of perseverance and traveling at night and so on. I traveled about 10,000 miles a year. But I had a chance to work with video. Not many people have done that, like Across the Fence. I made voice tapes, and these were used by our editorial office. And if I gave a talk on lawns, and sometimes for lawns, I made a series of 36 tapes, one a day for 36 days, starting in the spring, of things that you should do to improve your lawn. They were little short 3-minute deals. I did 36 of them at one sitting. I give this to my editorial office. They multiply it 20 times. They send it to every station serving Vermont, whether it's in New Hampshire, whether it's in New York State, maybe even up into Quebec, but they had a mailing list. And when those stations played it multiple times, I was heard a lot of times on tapes until some people said, you should run for governor. People have a knowledge of you that they wouldn't have of the candidates that are running. I use visual aids all the time because Jack Spavin at our editorial office, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words. And that's why the slides were so good. And if they weren't good, then I have reams of diagrams that I made or had made by him or by other qualified people to let people see visually the things that I'm talking about. So you want to be able to see, you want to be able to hear, and you want to be able to think while you're learning. I did a lot of special exhibits. One of them I called my lollipop ones. I made three large lollipops, which are boxes, a yard square, four-sided, mounted on a stick. The stick was down in an old rubber tire off the, you know, the spares you get on a car that you never use. And I welded a shaft into those, and these things would spin. Put Velcro on the top, and I made close-up pictures of every crop that grew in Vermont, plus some things that would amuse kids, and put four of them on each side. And if you spun the wheel, then you'd be able to see these. And what I lacked was a nice little motor that would turn it very slowly. But I took these to the Shelburne Fair. I did a lot of things like exhibits at the Eastern States Exhibition, where we tried to promote trefoil. I went to Montreal a couple of times to put out exhibits up there to help our growers sell their seed. I did demonstration plots. One year, for 1 month, I trucked a trailer all over the state and put out fertilizer with a special device that I made called a logarithmic fertilizer spreader, which I probably should have patented. And you could start out with this and drive across a pasture or a field and lay down 20-foot strips of fertilizer, and every 20 feet, the rate of fertilizer would change. And a farmer could look and say, now, how much fertilizer did you put on here? I like the looks of that plot right there, the third from the beginning. And I knew the third from the beginning because I calibrated it. It would be so many pounds of fertilizer per acre. And I know the nutrient I'm working with. That's what he says I like. He said, the other one over here, he said, you didn't get enough on. This one grew bigger. But he said, didn't do any good over here. That one there looked a little limp because I got too much. And so I did plots all over the state on every soil type. I did photo prints. and use these prints on the square designs that I just mentioned. I have a slight collection with just about everything that I wanted to show. I'd worked there after 31 years, and it's rare that you could ask me to speak on something that I couldn't find an illustration for. I did publications all over the place, and I also achieved enough goodwill so that I was asked to be one of the two people in the College of Agriculture. I was the only person in the College of Agriculture, I think, that was on Governor Salmon's Food Commission, which ran for 18 months. And we studied the food situation in Vermont. I personally wrote 100 pages of that publication, which nobody now today even knows about. And then I was chosen to go to the Northeast Agricultural Leadership Assembly, where people gave talks on different things. And we thought this was the assembly that was going to solve all meetings, the meeting to end all meetings. They had a $12,000 budget. And when the time came for a person to talk about the soils of New England, they had not done their work. And I got an emergency telephone call on a weekend in April. And in 2 weeks, they had to have this thing, and they wanted to know, could I do what he was supposed to have taken 18 months to do? And I said, yes, I can. And I gave a talk at that conference. I did agronomy recommendations for the department for years, both in crops and soils. I did a soil test slide rule system with colored slide rules that the agents were able to use, and that became also the basis for programming the present computerization of soil tests. I can't use a computer, but I provide the logic for the university computer that interprets soil tests to give the recommendations out to the farmers, and I think it's still being used. I gave agri-briefs and agri-aids to our agents, for my job was keeping them up to date all the time. And I also wrote several periodicals, 25 years for the Northern Milk Producer. I wrote for the old Farm Bureau before they ceased production. I wrote for the Nofin News for 25 years before they ceased production. I wrote for the Vermont Farmer when it first started out, which became the New England Farmer. I wrote for Yankee Magazine. I did an interesting article there called The Philosophy on Ashes about the burning qualities of wood related to the soils they came from. And then they wrote back and said, we never had an article like that before, and we need colored film, colored pictures. We never had color before. I sent them all the colored pictures of the trees that I was talking about, and even had a poem that was interested. And I used to write for the American Agriculturalist. It was published in Ithaca, New York for a long time. So I have a lot of things that I've been able to do to always test my ingenuity. How can I explain this better? How can I get somebody to understand this? Or, gee, I never thought about that before. I wonder if anybody else thought about that. And I try to give them something to think about that they had not thought about before. And I love to challenge people. I guess I'm a natural-born teacher, because if you ask me something, then I probably run off at the mouth too much, as the agents used to say. Wint's a good speaker if you can get him to stop. But I always tried to inject some kind of humor, if I could. Some old Vermont bit of history that nobody's thinking of anymore. Bring it back up and they love to think about it. Old time things. You know, we think 100 bushels of corn per acre, that's a big deal today. The old average used to be a third that. But in 1840, there's an American agriculturalist that shows that farmers were getting 100 bushels to the acre back then. Just no matter how much manure you could put on. They didn't have the fertility to do what we do today. And, of course, that's nothing, because a little guy named Omar Ratliff down in Mississippi took his daddy's land and took his wettest piece and best piece of ground, took his little horse out there and plowed the thing not once but four times in the course of the preparation. He plowed under so much manure and so much fertility. And 300 bushels per acre, which was the top record corn yield. I mean, if it's possible there, it shows that corn has that potential, and that most of the time we're growing it on a piece of land where something is left out, but you don't exactly know what it is. If you could just find out what it is, it would probably do more. But there also comes a limit to this, too. And when I went to speak about things having to do with environment in Montpelier one time, they wanted me to speak to the I gave a whole school assembly on pollutionist people. Then I had to speak to the environmental class on phosphorus and what it's doing to water. I had to go speak to the chemistry class on how nitrogen behaves in soils and why it gets lost and why you have to have more and how it's made. Then they wanted me to speak to the English class, and I spoke. They wanted me to speak on Thoreau. Now, I'm not an expert on Thoreau, but I was able to tangle some of my life together because having been to forestry school, I had courses in the changing landscapes and why we change and all of that. And then I'm supposed to speak to the math class. So what's an agronomist talk about with a math class? It's very simple because you have to stop and think that the world population is increasing and can double and double and double again. That's a geometric progression. And when you double things a few times, like you double compound interest, you can double money in 7 years. Huh? You can. When I was in World War II in India, there were 450 million people in India. Today, there's more than a billion. It has doubled in that time. If you look at food production, it can only go 1% or 2% a year. During the Green Revolution, it took quite a jump because Norman Borlaug, an agronomist, found out that he could have stiffer kinds of rice that wouldn't lodge if they put more nitrogen on, and he was able to increase the yields. That's a wonderful thing. And there are people asking us again now, why can't we do the Borlaug thing again? But there's a limit to how many times you can do that with plants. You can only do arithmetic increases, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 2, 4, 6, 8. You can't do double and double and double and double. So arithmetic versus geometric progressions, I spoke for 1 hour on to the mathematics class. And I hope I left them with some ideas that we've got a world out here that's got a lot of problems with the population that nobody knows how to stop. And a crop production that is not dwindling, but not increasing very much, and at best only a percent or two, if any. And that is going to be one of the greatest problems of all time, is to find enough sustenance to feed an expanding population that will surely double in another 50 years. When I was in India, I came away with the idea that I saw, even then, so many people in India, which was overpopulated then. And people say, well, what's the best thing that the British have done? And people used to say, well, they taught the people to use soap and water. And if they use soap and water, that's going to prevent disease. And they'll save a lot more lives. And I said, yes, a lot more people to starve to death.